Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, November 21st. Governor Josh Green talks candidly about what he thinks about President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks. He called one in particular insane. From Army Major General to East-West Center Prez to head of the Asia-Pacific Security Studies think tank, we hear from Suzanne, or Susie Barislam, as she makes the transition. We head up country to Kula, where we check in on efforts to restore more than 120 acres scarred by last year's wildfires. And in a nod to National Adoption Month, we highlight a new song penned by a Hawaii attorney. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The changing of the guard in Washington, D.C. next January will bring much uncertainty to longstanding institutions and policies. This morning, we had a chance to talk to Governor Josh Green, one of President-elect Donald Trump's controversial picks. Matt Gaetz just pulled his name from consideration as Attorney General. Here's reaction from Green.
Well, he's not a very good person, so it was good that he pulled his name. Everyone I talked to, and I mean mostly Republicans, when I was traveling the country last week, were really concerned about him being the chosen attorney general nominee. So Trump has won the election, and it's his prerogative to put people of an ideology that reflects that, but you have to put good people with experience in. And that was not the case with Mr. Gaetz, period. So it's a good thing that someone else will be attorney general.
And then you also called Trump's pick RF Kennedy insane.
It is. So RFK Jr., who actually applied to serve under President Obama in environmental capacity, which would be good. He's got some good credentials on environmental policies, is a terrible choice for Department of Health and Human Services. He cast doubt on vaccinations globally, and not just in Samoa, where I had to do the medical mission to go and vaccinate the whole country. But when he cast doubt on vaccinations there, 83 people died. If he did that across America, you would see large spread of measles, mumps, rubella, meningitis would spread. All of these concerns are very significant. Polio. And so God forbid we go back in time like that. It's clear that we've saved hundreds of millions of lives through vaccinations. And so once again, it's important to put the right people up for the right positions. And I hope that RFK Jr. will pull his name back and serve in some other capacity. He should not be confirmed, that's for sure. And it's not partisan. You know, for those listeners out there who maybe lean a little bit more towards Republican, it's important that we put good people who have training. And in this case, RFK Jr. does not have any experience as a nurse or a doctor or a social worker. He is not trained in public health. He's just a celebrity in this space. So the president needs to put people in there that have significant experience and credentials.
And what about Tulsi Gabbard? I mean, because that has been some of the criticism that has emerged, that she does not have the experience of, you know, in intelligence to lead that agency.
Well, in this case, I have less experience with her in that space. Tulsi served in the Congress for us for four terms, and she and I have a friendship going back. But on the flip side, again, I would hope that Trump picks people with significant experience. My general feeling about Tulsi was I thought that she would be the right nominee for the Department of Veteran Affairs. That's just my personal opinion because she is a veteran, and I thought that that would be the more appropriate position for her. I do know that today, I believe Nikki Haley, who is a serious Republican, almost won the nomination for the presidency on the Republican side if it wasn't for President-elect Trump. She came out very strong with her opinion, so maybe people should be referred there. Again, I prefer to stay in my lane and focus on where I have a lot of experience on those nominees. And RFK Jr. and Oz, Dr. Oz, should not at all be serving nationally in healthcare.
There is great concern about the targets that this administration may have. And I don't know how you're seeing what their plans are, you know, how it might impact Hawaii.
Yes. The concern I have right now about Dr. Oz, if he becomes the CMS leader or director, is that he might very well propose, and we've heard this, deep cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. Cost us as much as 10% of our Medicaid budget when Trump was last in office, and if he's got Elon Musk working with someone like Dr. Oz to cut those funds, a lot of vulnerable people will be hurt, and that's not okay. You know, like I said, I'm resolved to not be partisan and to just be thoughtful about the best, you know, opportunities for leadership in our country, but that would be a big deal. We have 465,000 people that need some Medicaid support to afford their health care here, and can you imagine if 100 or 200,000 people suddenly couldn't get access to health care? I mean, it would be catastrophic. So I'm just trying to be real. I hope people take it that way. We have to be thoughtful about those who are struggling, and that's, I think, a better way to govern. Some of these choices are just not terrific.
And we have been struggling with our rail system and funding for that. What are your thoughts on the pick for transportation and how it might impact rail?
Well, I talked to our director of transportation, Ed Sniffen, the other day about it, and he's over in D.C. making some relationships and checking in. Once again, and I don't know this gentleman personally, so I can't give a full endorsement or repudiation of the nomination, but my understanding is he mostly had chops in TV and was a commentator, and these are pretty technical jobs. The transportation department's very technical. The health department's very technical. So I wouldn't do that personally. I just think that it's better to put people where they have some good experience. I don't know how we got into this circumstance completely where TV celebrities and their numbers of followers on social media were more important than experience in the private sector or public sector in working on these really important problems. But that's where we are today, and that's what the election result gave us. So I would say we're going to have to weather a storm, and then in 2028, we'll hope for a better leader that cares about these key issues, Republican or Democrat. And maybe today is the first sign that there's going to be some balance between the Senate, the Congress, and the presidency, because it is good that Mr. Gates pulled his name back. That was really dangerous and really inappropriate because he was embattled. He's probably going to take it out on people that had done their ethics investigation of him. And also, you know, I think that there were some vulnerable children involved. And so that just kind of makes me cringe. So let's do the right thing by our people, frankly.
And, you know, you just returned from the National Governors Association meeting. What was a big takeaway for you?
Well, that was very bipartisan. I loved it. I was one of the faculty members for the new governors. And so I met with Republican and Democratic elected governors. There were, I think, 9 new ones. And I offered my experiences on disaster preparedness, disaster response based on our Maui experience, and just some commentary on what it's like to be a governor and what the pressures will be. They were terrific, very well received. I loved working with both parties, new governors, and they gave me a lot of insight into what's going on in the mainland. I'm very interested because, though I'm a regional governor and honored to be that, I also want to know what to expect and how the wave from Washington will hit us. And so that was terrific, and I'm honored to do that. I'm going to be the chairperson of the Western Governors Association starting next year, and apparently the president of the National Council of Government Officials, NSG, next year. So I'm trying to reach out a little bit more to take good ideas from those folks and give them some instruction on how we're using our Hawaii values to govern. But great people to work with.
Governor, I know while you're on the mainland, you talked to the New York Times and you were discussing the global settlement with the Maui wildfire lawsuits. I know you were venturing into the captive insurance aspect to see if where we could go moving forward.
Sure. If that's necessary, we absolutely will go there. You know, I will tell you, I'm trying to settle this amicably. The Supreme Court is going to rule sometime next month. They'll take their input from, you know, both parties. But in my opinion, we're going to put people and victims ahead of the major insurers. I have said this quite bluntly, that that is what should happen. The insurance industry has been holding out for $1.6 billion, and I have a reasonable offer on the table for them, much less than that, closer to $600 million as part of the settlement. And I hope that they take it, but the world of insurance is going to have to change. it can't take advantage of people that go through great, great harm. Just so everyone knows, in the last 20 years, the people, we in Hawaii, have paid $38 billion into property and casualty premiums, $38 billion, and we've received $14 billion back. So $24 billion extra dollars went into the profits of the insurance industry. And then when the wildfire occurred, they paid out so far $2.4 billion, and they're going to pay out, looks like, a total of $3 billion. But they're still over $20 billion ahead over our premiums, plus they get all that growth in the stock market. And it's really shocking. It shouldn't happen. And if they hold up the settlement, I'm going to speak this bluntly nationally. And I hope that others will share this interview and let people know that the system is broken and people are being victimized in their time of greatest need. So as long as I'm a voice, I'm going to be a strong voice of reason. So I hope that people are taking that to heart. It is not grandstanding. It's just reality. And I think our people on Maui and all across our state should have the benefit of this help. Now, if insurers don't decide to insure markets like Hawaii and California and Louisiana, where there are a lot of storms and risk, then yes, we'll have to solve the problem in other ways. And captive insurance, creating our own insurance model that does not have a profit, just covers costs, is something we could consider.
You know, one final question. You know, we did get a chance to talk to Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami, who told us that he is interested in the state's top job there on the fifth floor, either governor or lieutenant governor. Any thoughts on that?
I only can control what I do. My understanding was he said he liked the idea of waiting until there were vacancies. And so all the other elected officials should really search their heart and run whenever they want to. But I will absolutely be pursuing, you know, re-election to the governor position in 2026, and I'll make the announcement at the right time formally. I hope people see that my priorities have been the right ones on affordability, housing, homelessness, and of course, we've dealt with the Maui crisis in a way that no other governor has ever dealt with it. You know, they have seen that we advanced recovery much more quickly than most states ever dreamed of. So, you know, I'm really proud of our team, frankly, and it's an honor to serve as governor.
All right. Well, Governor Green, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we spoke with this morning. He expressed concern over some of President Trump's cabinet appointments, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s selection to head the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as Dr. Mehmet Oz to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Younger workers in Portugal are leaving the country in droves. High rents and low wages are pushing them out. The government introduced new tax breaks to get them to stay, but
to be honest, these measures are coming a little bit too late. If they really want to fix the country, they have a long road ahead.
Brain drain in Portugal, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Shore. He wrote for The Office, co-created Parks and Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and created The Good Place. His new comedy series, A Man on the Inside, stars Ted Danson as a widower who takes a job going undercover in an assisted living facility to investigate who stole a resident's necklace. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Relationship building across the Indo-Pacific has been a high priority for the U.S. with the growing tensions in that region. That has been a part of the mission of the East-West Center, as well as the Daniel K. Inouye Center for Asia-Pacific Security Studies. The transition between the two is what Suzanne, or Susie Barislam, is focused on as she takes over at the Department of Defense Center in January. She is stepping down as president of the East-West Center in December.
I'm really honored to be able to take on the role as director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, which really is a U.S. Department of Defense institute that officially opened September 4th, 1995 in Honolulu, Hawaii, right there in the heart of Waikiki. You know, people like to put it in a box of just a think tank, but it actually not just addresses a lot of the regional and global issues. It has amazing value in building networks of security professionals in the Indo-Pacific and beyond. You know, over the last 30 years, the Daniel K. Inouye APCSS has educated and really connected and empowered security professionals worldwide with about 16,000 alumni and 59 alumni associations. So really what it does, it brings together people from throughout the region to discuss these issues through courses, through workshops, education programs, as well as seminars and publications. So it has multiple elements, think tank element, and also bringing people together and bridging people. And it's really not just focused on war fighting, but they look at security in a holistic way, looking at what can undermine security and stability of a country. Topics that have been covered. And I'm alumna of APCSS also. I've been through two courses. So I can say that the topics are incredible. They range from maritime security, cybersecurity, economic security, environmental security, space policy, whole of society resilience, countering violent extremism. So you can see the topics definitely deal with peace, stability, and security. So the official mission is, of course, promoting a free and prosperous Indo-Pacific through collaboration. That's the vision, but its mission is to build resilient capacity, shared understanding, and a networked relationships among civilian and military practitioners and institutions to advance a free and open Indo-Pacific. So that's the mission of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies.
And you take over as the first woman, is that correct? And also Native Hawaiian?
Yeah, so yes. And also, I think, first alumna of the center.
And you take over from Admiral Peter Gumatautau, and, you know, he is a Pacific Islander, so kind of the first in this arena as well.
That's right. Rear Admiral Pete Gumatautau, retired, amazing surface warfare officer, also with roots to Guam, Pacific Islander, very proud Pacific Islander. So I have to walk, fill really big shoes. He's done an extraordinary job building bridges across the region, the Pacific, Asia, and the United States, and the world.
What do you think you bring to the table coming over as president from the East-West Center?
You know, having been here, I will complete here 3 years, and the mission of the East-West Center is to promote relations and understanding among people and nations of the United States, Asia, and the Pacific through study, research, and dialogue. And if you think about that mission, it really parallels that of APCSS, except the focus area is different. Non-traditional security elements here at the East-West Center, understanding the region, understanding that the role is to build really not just any old network. These are long-lasting connections and real relationships. And I think understanding the region, understanding why that's important and how important when we look at our alumni who all have said that East-West Center changed my life or APCSS changed my life. There are a lot of parallels, and I think I bring that. I'm looking forward to an opportunity to bridge the two institutions and leverage the dynamic relationship building that both institutions have. So I'm really thrilled to be able to bring those experiences I had doing that here at the East-West Center to the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies.
And the center is named for, you know, Hawaii Senior Senator Dan Inouye. Given the political climate, as we have a Republican administration now, I don't know, do you think that the organization could be a target?
You know, right now, the organization sits under the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Affairs and also the Director of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, and also the mission partner with U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. Certainly all the components that sit here. It is a key integral part of the mission of promoting collaborative, inclusive security. It has been since 1995 key and critical, and I think like here in the Marshall Center in Europe, there are different like organizations for different combatant command areas of responsibility. So this is an integral part of the larger whole of government defense strategy. So I think that it is, you know, just a key lever. So I am confident that it will endure as it has.
It might mean that it is insulated enough. I guess we'll just have to see.
I'm optimistic. I know that the great work, and you think about the alumni, the 16,000 alumni or 53 alumni association are all allies and partners, people who are very high level that have come through the program when they were younger and now have great relationships. It has played a significant role and is integral in the region and connection to the United States. I feel really optimistic about that.
Looking back over the 3 years at the East-West Center, I guess, what are you proudest of?
I am proud of seeing the amazing staff and people and alumni, 70,000 alumni, 53 chapters around the world, with small staff doing incredible work. The students and participants who come from 44 nations who live in this dorm. I'm proud to be able to help look at the legacy and create a strategy. We had the first strategy. We haven't had one in decades, so I'm really grateful to work with an amazing board. And by the way, it was a bipartisan board that worked us through the strategy of developing equipping leaders, which is our core mission, convening impactful dialogues like the APEC senior officials meeting, TriLAT, our Washington, D.C. office, where we have many Asia Matters for America, partnering with the Pacific Islands, the Pacific Islands Development Program. When I started, we had the first Pacific Island Conference of Leaders that we hadn't had in a long time. Our team resurrected the Pacific Islands report that was dormant for many years, increasing the Pacific Islands attendance by 113% just last year, increasing our student body within South Asia, Southeast Asia, Pacific, and across the United States, as well as working with the Hawaii Pacific Foundation and Alakaina, who are funding Native Hawaiian students, which is the first time in decades we've had Native Hawaiian students, graduate students, PhD in the dorm, as well as included in our Resilient Pacific Island Leadership Program. We did not have U.S. Pacific Islanders in our Pacific Islands Development Program with Dr. Mary Hattori, who's, by the way, now on the Board of Education. We now have opened some of our programming up to U.S. Pacific Islanders as part of the Pacific. We saw that with FESPAC and the First Lady and the Governor embracing all the Pacific. I was just in Tonga for the Pacific Island Forum, and they allowed us to have, for the first time, a separate panel on the sidelines of the Pacific Island Forum. Hawaii's Pacific Islands Development Program is the only U.S. institution as a member of the Council of Regional Organizations of the Pacific. And I'm proud to really cross over and work more closely with a lot of our partners, including the University of Hawaii, partnering for the first time with the Rockefeller Foundation, the Doris Duke Foundation at Shangri-La here. Having the legislature, Hawaii State Legislature, be a part of the East-West Center and revitalizing our connection with our Department of Education, with our Hawaii Youth Summit, with our graduate students from around the world, so our local students can be globally competitive, locally committed, which is the strategy of the Hawaii Department of Education. So connecting abroad, collecting locally, connecting nationally through this strategy, also fostering environmental solutions and supporting good governance through our journalism program. Like you, Catherine, you know, all of our amazing journalists who do great work since 1967, East-West Center has been doing that. And I'm happy that we had one of the most outstanding international media conferences in Manila this summer, with over 500 attendees and many of them alumni of the East-West Center, putting out over 100 plus articles from around the globe.
Free press is very important, particularly during these tumultuous times.
Absolutely. And then the last thing, of course, is trying to expand our women's empowerment entrepreneurship programs, working with the local community to do that.
Well, you know, and I think with your experience in the military and then experience working in the Indo-Pacific area, that there's part of a conversation, you know, that needs to be had where these nations and the native peoples have a seat at the table, whether they're negotiating military leases, just to be able to know that they can be heard.
Absolutely. That's very important. And, you know, I think there's a lot of efforts to make sure that dialogue is ongoing, you know, something that I've participated in before on land leases with the Native Hawaiian community, with key stakeholders in the area. And having been a part of those dialogues, what they call the Kahoa'oa process, where you can begin to understand the importance of land, place, people, and connection. And I'm happy to see that that's continuing.
That was Susie Barislam, East-West Center President and retired Army Major General. She is to transition to Executive Director of the Daniel K. Inouye Center for Asia-Pacific Security Studies in January as it prepares to mark its 30th anniversary.
Twice a month, over at lunch, black and white residents gather on Alabama's Gulf Coast to try to get past their differences.
If we can do it here in Mobile, in a city that has the scars we do, that the last lynching happened here, the last slave ship landed here, I think there's power in that.
I'm Juana Summers. We visit the Unify Project on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning this afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater. Mana Music Quartet, along with guests Kimie Minor, Kalani Pea, and others, celebrates its new album, Journey Through Hawaii, November 24th. HawaiiTheater.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we're headed out to the runway to explore a piece of Hawaii's aviation history. On April 17, 1935, a flying boat touched down in Pearl Harbor after a nearly 2,500 journey from Alameda, California. On board was mechanical equipment and about 150 pounds of mail. The Sikorsky Pan American Clipper was sent to the skies to determine the feasibility of long-range passenger flights across the Pacific, and the flight was deemed a smashing success. At the controls was one of the era's most famous pilots. Over the course of his career, he set 10 world records for Pan Am and piloted flights from California to Manila and New Zealand. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this pilot? And here's a hint, a road at the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport still bears our mystery man's last name. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
Wildlife recovery efforts in Maui are making headway in many areas, but especially on a tract of 8 acres of burn-scarred land in Kula. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel joins us to tell us more about the efforts of the Kula Community Watershed Alliance. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so you were just over there.
I was. The Kula Community Watershed Alliance
is made up of Kula community members who joined together after the fire to help protect the Aina in their area. And last week I got to walk around with Sarah Tekula, who is the executive director of the organization. And it was really neat to see the work that they've been doing, you know, having first walked up there, you know, just a week or two after the fire, seeing the destruction, and now to see native plants regrowing in these burned areas is really exciting. Shortly after the fire, they joined up with other local grassroots organizations like Malama Kula and started chipping the invasive trees that fell during that horrific wind storm that contributed to the fire. They spread mulch on these burn scar areas to protect them from erosion, and they say that those efforts have been really successful through last winter's rains. You know, the water ran clear that was trickling off of those areas instead of just running off all of this dirt that was left bare by the fire. And so they've stabilized, as you said, about 8 acres total of burn scar area in different on different properties in Kula, and they have about 120 acres total that they'll be working on for years to come. And so it's a big project, certainly not one that's a sprint, more of a marathon that we're talking about here. Tekula talks about a surprise that they found in one of their restoration areas, as well as some community events that they've held.
We've even seen, I don't know if you can see with the white flowers up here, that's Puakala. It's a native poppy, and that just sprang out on its own, which is really fun to see. While we were working on this and a few other areas that I'll show you, we were also having community members, fire-affected community members, come up and do seed collection up at Skyline and also up at the Pu'upahu Reserve, which unfortunately burned in the Crater Road fire this summer. And we did a propagation workshop so people could see how to germinate and grow. And then people took them home. And so hundreds of seeds went out into the immediate community.
Oh my gosh, and those native poppies, I saw one for the first time when I was over on Kauai last week at the National Tropical Botanical Garden, and oh, they're beautiful.
They are stunning, just so delicate and really beautiful white flowers. And so, yeah, there was multiple plants growing in this restoration area that they hadn't planted. You know, they just grew up after this area was restored. And so that's, you know, that was really exciting and hopeful for them to see. So dozens of community members in Kula have been growing these native plants and trees from seed. And a few of them were planted above Kula Sandalwoods Inn and Cafe where they were flourishing. That's one of the sites that I got to see. And Monica Louis has owned Kula Sandalwoods for the past 30 years or so. And she talks about how healing that process was for them.
This whole remediation of the hillside was a healing process for us. The whole experience was traumatic, and not knowing how we were going to take care of that hillside, which was in risk of landslide and property and human life. It could have endangered property and human life. For them to show up and help us was amazing. And it helped us because it was just on our mind every single day, what are we going to do? How are we going to take care of that? We don't have heavy equipment. We don't have funds. We went to FEMA. They said to look elsewhere. As much as the media wants to make it sound like the process is easy, just work through the agencies, it's not easy. It's not as easy as they say. And it's frustrating and stressful, but the Alliance and our community, they're healers.
Gosh, you can just hear the pain in her voice.
Yeah, and Kula Sandalwoods is still closed after the fire. They had a lot of damage to their business, and so yeah, you know, they're still struggling through that process. But you know, as Monica said, seeing this really steep hillside right behind the inn and cafe, you know, being restored is really hopeful for them. Last weekend, the Alliance had a planting event for the first of those hundreds of native plants and trees that were grown in backyards throughout Kula. And students and community members, many of whom were affected by the fire, came out and put those plants into their new home that's been stabilized with wood chips and logs on one of the restoration sites. And this site represents a lot in the organization's future, as Tekula explains.
We also are setting it up to become a kind of a living laboratory. So we'll try out some things in there that, you know, before we implement them on the landscape scale. You know, we're working on, I think, 120 acres of restorable land. And so we'll start with 600 square meters and see what happens with the soil and the water and the different species, how well they're doing. Because this is a little different than planting in a healthy space. You know, this is a space that's been really not just destabilized, but kind of chemically altered by the fire too. But what we're seeing over at Sandalwoods is that the plants are doing great. And so very similar conditions there than to what happened here. So we have every reason to believe it's going to thrive and survive, but it'll become a place where we bring the community, almost like a classroom. You can't see it from here, but just a short walk from this planting site is our community restoration nursery. And so between those two, I think these will become kind of a hub for curiosity and inquiry around restoration, and, you know, kind of monitoring and testing the soil, things like that. But then also, you know, a symbol for what's happening all throughout the rest of the burn scar.
Yeah, it's nice to hear her being so hopeful.
Yeah, and so that nursery that she mentions is in the works. It's currently in just sort of a gravel area, but they will be developing it soon for sort of larger scale growing for those 120 acres coming up. And Tekula talks about how the fire and recovery efforts have brought the community together.
When we started coming together with the community that was concerned about our watershed, and we kind of went around and said, you know, what's your superpower? What's your superpower? We recognized, wow, we have, you know, a team of superheroes here, you know, and we can really just tap into each other for what we need. And, you know, every once in a while call in other support, but it's really taught us that, you know, there is a lot of power in community. We've been really lucky and blessed to find that out about each other. Because this community didn't really, there were definitely great relationships before the fire, but it was nothing like what it is now. And, you know, that's what's going to get us through. This is not a short lived project by any means. You know, this is years and years of bringing the burn scar back to life and actually better than it was before.
Yeah, better and stronger. The community.
Absolutely. And along with those community efforts, there is some federal funding that will be coming to the area, the Emergency Watershed Protection Program through the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Under USDA, will be coming to do a lot of work in those really steep, dangerous gulches in Kula, where you know, it's not safe and pretty inaccessible for, you know, average residents to work in those areas. So there will be more help coming to the area, and that will be, you know, going along with community efforts to restore the area into the future.
Well, I'm jealous that you got to go walk that area. I haven't made it up to Kula yet, but hope to soon. But thank you so much, Catherine.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to HR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel about efforts to revitalize the land impacted by wildfires over in Kula, Maui.
When you support HPR, you help shine the spotlight on Hawaii's next generation of musicians.
How long have you been playing the violin?
I've been playing for about 7 years. I got my violin for Christmas when I was 6, and then I started playing probably a month after.
Hear from local students every Tuesday on HPR2's Classical Pacific.
I'd say just number one thing for really any musician, but even percussionists too, it's really just all about persistence and exactness. There will be times where, you know, you kind of get down about it, but there's always a light around the corner.
Help HBR uplift Hawaii's youngest musicians. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Okay, now it's time to engage our landing gear and reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we remembered one of the first flights from California to Hawaii that ushered in the modern era of trans-Pacific passenger flight. Almost 90 years ago, a Pan American flying boat touched down minutes before 8 a.m. in Pearl Harbor. The aircraft carried mail that in today's money bore postage fees of up to $50. A well-known pilot helmed the flying boat for this flight and others. He was once featured on the cover of Time magazine. We asked you to name this 20th century aviator who also lent his last name to a road at the Honolulu Airport. Our mystery man is Edwin C. Music. Music was originally from St. Louis, Missouri, and he was interested in flight from an early age. In fact, in 1912, we're told at the age of 18, he and a few friends built their first airplane. It reached an altitude of 9 feet before promptly crashing. Music did attend flight school the next year and joined the Army Air Service and Marine Flying Corps later in life. And our winner today, Ronnie LaChapelle from Honolulu, hope I pronounced that right, shares that she has family history in aviation. Her uncle was on the flight before and lives to tell the tale. How cool is that? Well, that's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Today we share a song to mark National Adoption Month. Former public defender Roxana Jimenez wrote it and collaborated with singer Mel Kay to record the single entitled Mommy. We also hear from Esther McDaniel, executive director of Harvest Family Life Hawaii. It's an organization that works with foster families, and she's seen the power of what an adoption can do for a child's future. Jimenez says when she started her legal career on the mainland, she worked with cases that involved children in crisis, and that was the inspiration for the song and the desire to share the healing power of an adoption.
They had me representing troubled children, most of the times teenagers, but also younger children that were in crisis. And many times they would have to be placed in foster care, and I would visit them there and meet with the staff and just, you know, track their progress and then give those reports to the Department of Health and Family Services. And so when they were eventually placed in permanent homes, I saw just how they transformed and how their lives improved, and duly how the families that adopted them, how they were enriched. So that was a big part of being inspired to write this song. And then in my own personal life, when I was 13, my aunt, who had struggled with infertility, brought Elizabeth into our family, and she is such a joy, and our birthdays are very close, and so, you know, we always call each other on our birthdays, and now she's a mother of three, so, you know, I have a part in the song where it talks about the grandchildren who eventually come after, you know, years of having an adopted child in the family. And it's just generational, the beauty of having adoption in your family. And I wanted to inspire people to also consider that decision if you have the means, if you have the time. It's something that just ripples for generations. And that was a big part of it. And then now being in Hawaii, Hanai adoption is so embedded in our culture. And I thought, couldn't Hawaii be the model, you know, a song coming out of Hawaii to inspire the whole world? You know, additionally, it's, you know, if you're thinking about talking about adoption to your child, if you haven't told them when they were younger, you could play the song and say, hey, you know, this is how you came into our lives and how you made it more beautiful.
Oh, what a wonderful thought. What mm-hmm. a wonderful idea. And then you were able to collaborate on this
yes,
song with somebody you were taking music lessons with, is that right?
Yes. So Mel is a very talented, very accomplished musician, and I was taking music lessons with her, and I said, Mel, can you help me with this? And we just started working on it, and it became what it is, and we've become good friends, and we take our dogs on walks together.
And Mel, you sing this song
yeah.
as well. And so what was it like for you knowing that the inspiration for this really was heartfelt?
I just
I really love the message, and I think we all strive for a sense of belonging. And I think in adoption, people are giving kids that gift to feel like they really have a place to belong. So if I can like collaborate on something to do with that, that would help people to feel less alone, then yeah, that sort of really pulled me in to wanting to work with it. Yeah.
Well, then let's just take a listen to this song. Put our listeners into the space.
Hard to imagine life before we knew how happy ever after was you. Your adoption was never an option. Your home was with us all along. An angel of fate came down and told me.
Yeah, I mean, beautiful song, beautiful song. It puts you in that space. Yeah, not an option, adoption. It's just like you're just meant to be. And that's the whole thing, part of a family. And at this point, I want to bring in Esther McDaniel, because you are with Harvest Family Life Hawaii, and you work with a lot of foster families that sometimes result in an adoption.
Correct. Yes. In the state of Hawaii, there's thousands of phone calls that come into the hotline for children who are abused and neglected or in some way harmed. And across the nation, it's something like 435,000 children are in the U.S. foster care system. And so primarily, we work with families to help them be able to receive their children back home, to go home again. So reunification's, you know, the goal. But many times it will end up in what they say permanency, legal guardianship, or adoption. And that's how Roxana and I have this commonality, in that I get to see every week, sometimes every day, talking about adoption and what that looks like in helping a child find a forever family.
And so when you first heard this song, what did you think?
Amazing. Just so peaceful and calming and good news. Do you know how many children are waiting and hoping for that forever family? As well as there are children who are a little bit older and maybe they just want to go out into life, you know, on their own. But you still need a forever family, whether that's legally, you know, through the court system, or hanai, where even if you decide I don't want to be legally adopted, I want to chart my own way, but you still need a family.
You just want to share this song because it means so much to you.
Yes. Like Esther mentioned, you know, most children want to be back with their parents. And, you know, I've been in those hearings where, you know, judges would like to terminate parental rights. And many times we can craft resolutions where the children are still in contact with their biological parents, but they're in a safer place, they're in a more stable environment with a new family. So I've seen the success stories with that and how the children have improved in their schoolwork and their health. And I don't really want to go into detail as far as the horrible stories I've seen as far as, you know, children abuse, but when they are placed in a stable family, just to see their eyes light up and to know that they are safe.
Yeah, they thrive, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
In a good environment. And Esther, talk about what percentage of foster families in foster care results in an adoption.
Yes, mostly in my own personal experience as a foster parent, about 75 to 80% of the children that we fostered did get reunited with their family. But nationally, it's about 20% of foster cases that end up in them being adopted or legal guardianship with another family. So I had the good fortune, the blessing of interviewing Tiffany, who's 10 years old now, and her mom, who met her at the hospital. She was a nurse, and Tiffany was born with a medical condition. And many times people are scared, you know, they're frightened to say, how will I bring home a child who has a high medical need? Well, Tiffany's mom, Val, she did that and said, okay, I'm going to foster her, and eventually adopted her. And she's just healthy and whole and vibrant. And something that Tiffany said too, when I asked her, what would you want other young people who are adopted, or just young people in general, what would you want them to know about adoption? She says, well, if they're adopted, don't feel bad. It's not your fault. Because I think so many times children think, why didn't you choose to raise me, you know? But she said, it's not your fault. And she said, just look at it as double the love.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And then Mel, I guess talk about the joy that this song brings when people hear it, knowing that it's so heartfelt.
Yeah, I think that we all search for that sense of belonging. And I love how the song connects to the joy of adoption. I think we, like Esther was mentioning, you have people saying, well, why did this happen? But I love how there is a deep peace in it, and that love that sort of comes through the lyrics and the melody to soothe. And I think that recognizing that in some ways, people choosing you and choosing to love you for your whole life is just as beautiful in its own way as being biological, you know?
I just think I've been very blessed that I had a terrific family, you know, and I know that's not always the case, but, you know, to think that, yes, this song does raise the awareness of people about the need and about what a beautiful thing it is when you can provide a safe place for children.
Definitely, mm-hmm. Yeah. I have been working in music for over a decade. I've written a bunch of music in Australia and in Hawaii over the last 3 years. We had a couple shows at the Slack Key Lounge in the past year. I think the core of what I do, though, I found my purpose quite a while ago when I actually was on tour and wound up in hospital. And I spent 6 days next to an Anglican priest's wife. And I think from that point, my direction changed and I moved more into what does my purpose look like. And for me, that purpose is really important, and that's to try and help people feel less alone through music. So that really connected to the message of this song.
We are blessed that we have this song, and we are grateful that we had a meeting of minds and folks came together to produce it. And why don't we see if we can play some of the song going out?
Hard to imagine life before we knew how happy ever after was you. Your adoption was never an option. Our home was with you all along. An angel of fate came down and told me that I was meant to be your mommy. Now you got a family of your own, and you pass along our traditions. More little feet come up the cobblestones. You gave us everything we were wishing. Hard to imagine life before we knew how happy ever after was you. Your adoption was never an option. Our home was with you all along.
You have been listening to a song about adoption in a nod to National Adoption Month. You know, before that, we were listening to a conversation between Roxana Jimenez, singer Mel Kay, and Esther McDaniel. We will have links to the song and resources on the conversation page of our website later today. Well, that does it for us. We're out of time. But up tomorrow, in the spirit of giving thanks, we Hanaho stories about inspirational teachers that we broadcast recently. Have a teacher that you want to give a shout out to? Share their story with us. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, and record something, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.